Recent research has determined that health can be affected by being outdoors. Being outdoors can have a positive effect on your health. And what is the effect when being outdoors is a major part of your culture? What's the connection between traditional culture and well-being? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guests today are Tim Frande. He's a folklorist and outreach specialist at the UW-Madison's Collaborative Center for Health Equity and Native American Center for Health Professions. And he's also an expert in Scandinavian studies, particularly the Sami peoples. And we'll get into that in a minute, too, briefly. With me also is Wayne Valier, who is a teacher and the director of Ojibwe Language and Culture at Lac des Flambeaux Public School. Welcome both to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us both.
So we're calling this decolonizing health. And what does that apply to? Where does the term come from, Tim?
Decolonization?
Yeah.
Well, decolonization has been talked about for several decades now in indigenous communities and in indigenous studies and the discourse of it. And basically it means undoing the processes of colonization that have enacted trauma in indigenous communities over the course of several generations.
So you're talking about, for example, the intent to assimilate Native American cultures that went on over the course of, for a long time, but particularly in the 19th century and into the early 20th?
Well, you're talking about that as well as more horrible things like genocide and boarding schools, and in addition to the destruction of traditional Native economies, the environment, and how it continues on today.
And how did you get into this topic?
I did my PhD work with Sami people and Anishinaabe people, so it's a natural sort of fit. You work with indigenous people, and these are indigenous issues.
Okay, as long as I've set it up, I've got to figure out why the Sami, which of course are indigenous people of Scandinavia and Finland, and the Ojibwe and other indigenous people of northern Wisconsin. How did you combine those two in your area of interest?
Well, you know, there's personal connections I have to both communities. I've got family lines that are part of both communities. But, you know, academically speaking, there are connections with indigenous people all throughout the world because indigenous communities have a shared experience with in terms of reacting to colonizers.
There is kind of a parallel there, isn't there? If you go to Scandinavia and go to some of the museums there now, you'll start to see exhibits of Sami culture. Culture that would have been really suppressed until the last couple of generations.
Right. Things don't get better in Sápmi until about 1990 or 1970, you can say. It depends on how you want to start.
Kind of a world movement, do you think? Because, of course, in this country, well as the 1970s, wasn't it that Americans, other than Native Americans, became really aware of Native American culture in a kind of a legitimate sense or a serious sense?
Well, it was at that time that that Native Americans, through policy of the U.S. government, start to actually legally have be able to be part of their children's education and the public school systems. Looking at the historical trauma that's happened to our people, it evidently didn't work for our people. A lot of social problems had been created internally within our reservation. Different things had happened. There was a lot of different programs and a lot of different systems that had been tried with Native Americans, all failing. A lot of them they were just going down the tubes. After Native Americans got involved in education of their children, bringing culture into the school systems and being part of the school, it's a long study show that when children see themselves in school, they do better. We recently really took a re-look at that and have strengthened our culture in our school. And we've gotten very good results as far as the academics of our students. Identity loss was a big problem on a reservation up until 1970. Native people some people went as far as being shamed of keeping it under the carpet that they were Native American, fear of being patronized by white society. There's a lot of stories of people coming out and saying these things today. So when we brought traditional knowledge back into the school, our children started to take ownership of it. And me personally, I am a part of that first generation that was involved in having natives coming in with language into our school, old traditional games and old stories, and talking about who we used to be, giving strength to us, giving identity to us. So it's a part of my life that I went back to, I guess, and re-examined and using school today, and spent my life basically learning this knowledge so I can pass it on to our younger generation.
How much did you actually have, I mean, before this experience of the reintroduction of culture, how much of the Ojibwe culture were you aware of?
Well, like I said, I've been part of the culture all of my life. You have to understand that there has been families, traditional families, that have kept alive culture in our respective communities. People that had to go underground with our ceremonies, with our language. All of this had happened. They kept it by the wayside for us to come pick up later in life. And luckily we had the people like myself that have stepped forward and have taken on that challenge to reintegrate our culture back into our society, our traditional people society. And I guess that by giving this identity to our people, it's you asked the question earlier about the connection of outdoors and health to our people. We call it purposeful exercise. And what purposeful exercise is we go out into a boat, canoe through a very dense rice bed to harvest food. It's all work to process this wild rice that comes from our rice beds in northern Wisconsin.
It looks like a lot of work.
And then in the end, when we eat that rice, it's very, very healthy food to eat. We're re-examining the healthy foods and also looking at the lifestyle changes in cooking and the different foods that we traditionally ate then, and went from a hunter-gatherer society to the society that we are today, eating fried foods and different unhealthy things. So we're also bringing awareness of our traditional foods also that are putting our people on a healthy path of life.
Do you have a sense, Wayne, that there were some things, though, that in this, whatever you want to call it, assimilation or colonization process, were there things that were just lost, completely lost?
Oh, yes. You know, it's a known fact that throughout indigenous country of North America, in 1492, when Christopher Columbus landed on the eastern seaboard, there was approximately 350 different languages being spoken in North America. Today, there is less than 150. Now, some of those languages were just lost to colonization, but other whole peoples and tribes have been extinct. Some eradicated by colonization through disease, smallpox, other things like that. So there's been a quite extensive dark history that surrounds that kind of stuff.
How do you observe Columbus Day?
I guess how I observe Christopher Columbus is, first of all, I guess let me put it like this. I come to your backyard and I say, hey, I found you. how would you take that? So it's known that he was Christopher Columbus was in search of the West Indies became lost, and you know the rest of the story. We did not discover our people. The Anishinaabe people have been in this on this Turtle Island for a long, long time. And our history and our stories are still very much alive in our culture with our people. And it's growing all the time. And it's very positive impacts on our community.
Because people need that connection with who they are.
Exactly.
And where they came from.
Exactly.
How many speakers are there of the Ojibwe language?
Well, you see, Ojibwe Mo'in is not in jeopardy globally. It's on record as one of the most, as the Anishinaabe Mo'in is on record as the most complex language in the world. Ojibwe Mo'in is not in jeopardy globally, which is our tribes are throughout the Midwest and the provinces of Canada. What is in jeopardy are our respective dialects of Ojibwe Mo'in. They are very much in jeopardy. We are now down to less than 5 fluent speakers in our community. I've spent the last 25 years of my life to try to obtain as much of this language and teach it as I possibly can. And thus the programming, bringing hands-on, bringing our language to life and hands-on usage. Our students are speaking. And my community, we went from 25 years ago to very little understanding of Ojibwe Mo'in to today we have basic understanding community-wide. It took the U.S. government over 100 years to take our language away. It's going to take some time to get it back, and we're doing that.
What about the Ojibwe Mo'in language as a written language? I mean, it would not have been originally, would it?
Excuse me?
In other words, does it help or hinder? How does the whole writing down of a language play into the preservation of it?
It has its pros and its cons. Back in 1970, a linguist by the name of Fierro created what we use today. It's called a double vowel system. It's based on seven basic vowels, and phonetic English phonetic language is added to the front. The reason it's so effective is because we can say a word in Ojibwe language, an old tamarack fence. We could have everybody in the room write the word in English, and chances are, pass our papers across the room, and we would say a totally different word. But with the double vowel system of writing, it is very consistent and very close to the way the word would be said. So it's just a matter of adjusting dialect after that. So,
can you give me some more of that language, the sound of it?
Blueberry pie. Ojawashkomini, Bashkomini Sijigun, Bitu Sijigun, Bakwe Jigun. And Ojibwe Mo'in, our language has a spirit that lives within our language. It is a living language, and it surrounds us. It surrounds us in the forests. It surrounds us in our waters and our lakes. Everything that we see is respected and has a purpose. And there are no swear words in our language.
No kidding.
It's a very respectful language and a language that honors all creation and honors human beings. And it's a very complex language. We have English language, for example, has 3 tenses, past, present, and future. Ojibwe Mo'in, we have 4 tenses in our language, past, present, future, 2 future tenses, 1 future possible and a future definite tense, and also 3 forms of our language, the A, the B, and the change conjunct form of our language is a very complex. I guess to explain it all in a nutshell, I could say a short phrase in Ojibwe Mo'in, and I would have to write a whole page of English to explain what I just said. That's how complex our language is.
Do you, I assume, then have also many different terms for what might be a single word or two in English? to specify certain conditions of...
Yes, we have a word for everything around us, every emotion, every color, everything a human could possibly see, every state. And recently we had to create certain words because obviously we didn't have a word for television.
Yeah, sure.
So our language is very descriptive. We talk about Mazanatesichigan, which means the moving pictures, describing what a television is. Many of our words, including the animals, have a story on how they got their name. There's extensive stories on all of our animals, why they have their name. And so that's the way we see them.
I want to get to one of those stories in a minute, but you mentioned canoes a while ago. And Tim, are you actually involved in making canoes?
Yeah. Wayne and I have built three canoes together.
Birch bark?
Yeah, all three were birch bark. And then we're going to be building a dugout canoe next.
I've seen a little bit about how to make a dugout canoe. That involves burning, doesn't it? You cut off, of course, the trunk and then hollow it out with fire?
Yes.
Yes.
And how do those things float? They look so heavy. They look like they'd be so heavy in the water, not to mention a little uncomfortable, a little cramped, unless it's a really big tree. How does it work?
Well, Wayne's been the one who's paddled them.
Very, very, very buoyant. The really? Cadillac of our watercrafts. And you have to understand the birch bark canoe. When the colonists came here, they didn't use their old wooden boats to explore America. They used a superior craft, which is the birch bark canoe. You could portage it, carry it across land, and drop it into another body of water, paddle 9 miles, and cross the land much quicker than you could possibly go around the many lakes in the Midwest. The dugout canoe was used more for larger chains of lakes, okay?
It's going to be very
500-year-old white pines would be felled. It's a 2-year process. 500-year-old white pines were felled. They were stickered off the ground for let dried for a whole year to sit. And also, it was a communal event. The people in the whole village owned the dugout canoe. Then controlled burns would happen. They would burn the whole log, let it sit again for another year, then come back and start the carving process. Controlled burns. There would be a head carver. He would instruct how it was going to happen. So different families would participate. And at an early date, they used fire and asiga, which are clam shells, to burn
it.
And scrape. And then later when Anishinaabe obtained steel from the Europeans, we started to use steel to chisel out the inside, actually making it a faster thing. So then there are different holes that are punched throughout the canoe to check the depth, so it has a consistent width throughout the canoe.
Sure.
And they're replugged in the end. The reason for the dugout canoe was kind of like... when you were in a large chain of lakes, when a family on a camp of Anishinaabe would be camped at one area, they would have to relocate their belongings to, say, the berry patch or the rice beds or their hunting grounds. It was much easier to take one load in this huge dugout canoe and get your belongings to a certain area and then send it back for the next family to use. Okay, rather than taking 15 trips for the birch bark canoe. And they were communal property. So, and Lac-Tu-Flambeau at our George Brown Museum, we have a 500-year-old dugout canoe that was found in Lac-Tu-Flambeau Lake. And we restored it, and it is on display there.
Dimensions.
There is another one in Lac Vieux d'Isere up in Watersmeet, Michigan. But they, the Anishinaabe, they've used those crafts, and also our ancient brothers who occupied the area before the Anishinaabe came into this area, which was the Dakota. They also created the great dugout canoes.
Well, of course, it helps to have available a 500-year-old tree, which would be a little hard to come by now. In fact, even if you could come by one, you would probably be arrested for chopping it down.
Well, we have some ancient growth left on our reservation, where we also have our Chippewa treaty rights also, where we can go on to federal land and for ceremonial purposes and exercise our treaty rights to hunt, fish, and gather in the ceded territory to harvest such a thing. Our projects, we've also collaborated with Wisconsin DNR and the U.S. Forest Service to harvest some of these materials for our past projects. It was a very good collaboration, helped us a great deal. It was very educational for our students, and it brought our students into a place of good health. The exercise was there, the knowledge was there. And also the good food was there in the forest.
Can't overlook that. We're going to delve more deeply into the world of Ojibwe culture and the connection to health and culture when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Tim Frandy, folklorist and also an outreach specialist for the UW-Madison's Collaborative Center for Health Equity. And my other guest is Wayne Valier, who is a teacher and director of Ojibwe language and culture at Lac des Flambeaux Public School. And we're looking at the connection between culture and health in this context in particular of the history of Native Americans and in particularly the Ojibwe people. And I want to get a better sense, Wayne, of life on the reservation. I mean, nobody has to live on the reservation anymore. Nobody has had to live there, for almost 100 years now. But how has life on the reservation evolved tell us exactly where it is, too, for that matter.
Well, you know, I guess the first thing that comes to mind is back in the Relocation Act, back in, I believe, in the 1950s, where my grandparents were given an opportunity to leave the reservation. A lot, like a lot of Native people throughout the country, they were promised jobs and a better life in major cities like Chicago, is where my grandmother went. A lot of Native people, so they up and they went to those places. They wanted to get the Native people off the reservation because there was, you know, a lot of despair on the reservation at that night in 1950. I guess what happened was when the Natives got down there, the housing was poor and the jobs really weren't there. But there were a lot of Natives that did stay in metropolitan areas.
Did they stay as groups, or were they scattered?
Well, according to what my grandmother had told me, there was a lot of Native people kind of attracted to, you know, each other in the metropolitan cities, and there was a seasonal trek that would happen back to the reservation. Mm-hmm. They would go back to the reservation during the wild rice harvest or the maple sugar harvest, bringing some of these traditional foods back, a taste of home back to the city, to supply themselves because of low income and supplement their food and their livelihoods there in the metropolitan area. Since then, the story, the Lac des Flambeaux, I can't speak for the other reservation, but Lac des Flambeaux, there was a lot of struggles in our community. Jobs were very, very few and far in between. We had Simpson's Electric that came after World War II and employed a lot of Native Americans on our reserve. A lot of a very menial job. And logging industry, the resorts, a lot of, I guess, service work for different hospitality work for people. So there wasn't a lot of income. And at that time, people were very uneducated. There was very few people going on to higher education because, you know, the need to work for their families and provide food and put food on the table for families. It wasn't until, after 1970, when Native people started to get involved in education and public school systems of their children, the American dream seemed to be more obtainable then, because our people started to take ownership in the school systems. I can remember my father telling me, when I was a young child coming home from school, saying that back when he was a child, he was very, very quiet. And most of the children were taught that they didn't speak unless they were spoken to. And there was all this low self-esteem. He said, but I seen that change in my own children after you guys start coming home from school, you coming home talking about your culture, talking about American history, talking about what you want to be when you grow up, and talking about the power of education. And so I come from quite a large family, and all of my brothers and sisters are educated people like myself. They are leaders in our community that have came back to our reservation to serve our people. And that is the etiquette that we try to, instill in our young people, is that, understanding who you are and your identity. Take that knowledge, because it's obvious we can't live in wigwams. We can't paddle the canoes and fish off the land because of the depleted resources. So we have to live in Western society, okay? But we don't have to lose our value to do that, okay? So we have programming and programs that are in set in our communities through our gaming dollars that are helping our education to better our community, telling our kids to go out and get your education, come back to our community, become our water specialists, become our doctors, become our attorneys, become our blood specialists and our nurse and our professional people throughout our community. And we are a nation within a nation. We are a sovereign nation. And it's sovereignty at its purest form, being self-sustaining, having our people come back. And now it's starting to happen. We are having graduates from Madison coming back, director of our education department, having attorneys that are Native coming back, having business people coming back, serving our community in a very good capacity, making our businesses and our systems successful in our community from Native value.
And it sort of builds on itself, doesn't it? The more expertise you have going back into the community or the reservation, the more desirable that place becomes and the more people are likely to come back.
Exactly. But we're doing it our own way, the Native way.
And is there any kind of connection between Native American on the reservation education and the federal, state level of education?
Well, we've created a system called the Envision Program. And what the Envision Program is, not teaching culture, but teaching culturally, okay? Teaching from the cultural aspect, teaching culturally with cultural value. Our kids are taking ownership of it much quicker than the past, back in the 60s, when in our public school back home, it would be our students would come from impoverished homes into the public school where they were taught the American dream. Well, at 3 o'clock every day, the staff, who was predominantly non-Native, would jump in their brand new cars and drive off the reservation. Well, the American dream would drive off with them. So today, we're changing that. We have Native Americans that are professionals and are people, our children can look up to that today. That's what the change is. And we are starting to kindle the fire of hope within our community, and also understanding that there's nothing that we can't overcome as a people today, and we're doing it.
Is there at all any irony when the children or children of your generation would come home and with something that they'd learned about Ojibwe culture, and your father, your grandfather would say, I didn't know that?
Yeah, it's happening a lot.
Really?
It's happening a lot. As a matter of fact, a lot of my students from the public school that are learning very complex phrases right now, I have a lot of parents approaching me in the community saying, wow, my child is coming home and I'm learning from my child. So we started a program where we're going to create language manuals. I'm creating a language manual called Command and Stole the Children, so that our teachers at the school can send it home with the children so they can teach their parents. And it's all about bringing our language back.
Tim, I know you've done considerable research on this connection between culture and health. And how did you get into that, and what did you find, and what were the obstacles?
Well, like you said before, I'm a folklorist, so I had always worked in cultural studies, and I was able to get a job working with Native communities in the School of Medicine and Public Health here on campus. And to me, it was quite apparent from the beginning that trying to take health programs that might be successful in some place like Middleton, Wisconsin, and try to put them into not only rural Wisconsin, but Native Wisconsin, it could be incredibly problematic. There are the economy's got different challenges in the North. It's hard to find work up there for a lot of people. There's the grocery stores, you know, people want talk about organic produce and healthy eating.
Sure.
But, you know, your healthiest eating in the North, it's venison, it's wild rice, maple sugar. It's the stuff you harvest yourself. And that's your exercise, too. And
right,
there
sure
are some gym facilities around, but, you know,
it's not the same, is it?
I grew up in a way, just like Wayne, I know, that, you know, if you didn't have something to do, it was time to go to the woods, and it was time to do work. You're hunting, you're fishing, you're picking berries, you're making firewood, and that's being in the woods is sort of your answer to all your problems. You're in a bad mood, go to the woods. you need some food, go to the woods. It fixes everything in a way, but in so many of the problems that Native country, Indian country has with health can be solved through Native methods, you know, by using the woods in traditional ways, and ways that, you know, you're not importing a health program that might fix a health problem and sort of fall into this assimilation paradigm that's really common whenever universities or, you know, federal institutions try to work with Native communities, but instead you can create a health program that makes the culture stronger when after the Native youth or Native adults go through it. So I think you can do both.
Well, as you say, too, the woods is a double fix because it improves your attitude, improves your health. I mean, and this has been demonstrated physiologically that people actually are healthier walking in the woods for 3 miles than walking in downtown Chicago 3 miles. I mean, both are exercise, but one is healthier exercise than the other. And if you're doing this in terms of gathering or preparing food or capturing food, at the same time, you also take a little more satisfaction, don't you, in consuming the food?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so you also have to look at the state of the human being, you know. The state of the human being is we weren't designed to walk on concrete.
Good point.
We were designed to walk on the earth. So Native people, we choose to walk on the earth, keep our feet on the earth. She is our mother, our grandmother. She gives us life, and she's also highly respected. So that when we're out there walking in the forest, when we notice a tree, we talk to our children. We tell our children, you see that tree? that tree was alive when your great-grandparent was alive. That tree knows your great-grandparent. You see that sky over there that's tinted with red. Appreciate it. You only get to see that so many times in your life. We teach our children to appreciate their environment. And you're breathing clean air and you're exercising, you know. It's a very good way to live. It's a very peaceful, it's a very good way to live in harmony with creation.
And then you mentioned a little while ago, Wayne, of course we're mostly familiar with some hunting rights, some fishing rights, and you even mentioned those, some timber rights. Explain to us, how extensive those are for, say, the Ojibwe, or would this apply to all yes. Native peoples of Wisconsin?
Well, what a lot of people don't understand is that our tribes, the Ojibwe tribes of Wisconsin, they were land sections at the time. There was different treaties that were signed. The most important one that we use is this Treaty of 1854 that was signed with the U.S. government. What people don't understand is we gave up all the lands in Wisconsin and part of Minnesota and all the UP for the right to obtain, to hunt, fish, and gather on the land like our ancestors did. So recently in the 80s, we reaffirmed these treaty rights. And because of it, something good has happened. The tribes have become co-managers of the resource in these areas. And the resource is getting better because of it, because of our philosophies on conservation. Our philosophies on conservation go way back. One of our values are keepers of the earth. A good example would be when families would hunt a certain area. There were certain territories that were divided up amongst families. Each year, every 2 years, the families would switch over to a different territory and hunt that territory.
Oh, kind of like a
letting
crop rotation.
Letting the game rejuvenate itself. Mm-hmm. Only 2 years later to return to that area. The other families knew that hunting ground and didn't go into that hunting ground knowing that it was this family that hunted that area. And it was respect of other people's families that was a way of conservation and kept the Anishinaabe alive for a long time in this area.
And is that still being practiced now then, this sense of family zones?
On the reservation, the etiquette that we try to tell our young people is only harvest what you need, okay? And always leave something for seed. Someday your grandchildren may come looking for that. So make sure it's there for them. So as an educator, I bring that into our public school and talk to our students all the time, the importance of that. And our etiquette is when making decisions like that, we imagine a baby and what we call a cradle board. A cradle board is a receptacle we keep our children, our babies in. We put that baby way down the road, way down the road, barely seen. And that represents seven generations. And decisions that we make today, if they're good enough for that baby way down the road, then they're good enough for us today. So we make them.
And how did the fishing rights apply?
So the fishing rights, the hunting and fishing rights apply in Waswaganing. We are hunters and gatherers. We harvest probably more game than most tribes in the state of Wisconsin. But also we consume more game and fish and traditional foods than most of the tribes in Wisconsin. Our foods are... For example, a Ojibwe spear fisherman that goes out at night, the public sees 90 walleye fish in a tub being brought in one night, okay? So what people don't understand is those 90 fish will be taken back to the reservation and shared with several families that don't have fishermen. That to supplement their income, their food bills, and have that what we call spirit food that the Great Spirit gave the Anishinaabe, the Ojibwe people, to survive on. And also, our our modern Glyphwick Great Lakes Fish and Wildlife Commission, we have what we call a TAC limit, which means total allowable catch. Our biologists go out and survey each water that we harvest, and so we only get a certain number of fish, the total allowable catch, safe harvest limit. So each fish is measured, it is sexed, and it is counted. The tribes know exactly how many fish out of every body of water that is harvested each year. The question is, does the state of Wisconsin know the same?
Yeah. Lac de Flambeau, that name comes from the French seeing the tribes hunting at night with their flame torches
on the
river.
That's interesting you bring that up. We call, or we come from, our Ojibwe name for our area is Waswaganing. It means Lake of the Torch. The first time that we came into the area, there was a fireball dancing on the lake. An old man taught our people how to do this method of Waswawin, which is fire hunting, harvesting deer as well as fish by artificial light, casting upon the waters. So our people adapted to the technique several hundred years ago, okay? Other tribes came through our territory and saw our people at night harvesting and hunting by torchlight, naming our area Waswaganing, the Lake of the Torch. Now, people don't understand that our territory went way over almost to Phillips, Wisconsin, all the way over east to the headwaters of the Wisconsin River by Eagle River, and all the way down to the south where present-day Wausau is. Wausau is an Ojibwe word, which means far away. Okay? So 250 years later, after Wemitikoshi Winitiwook, the stick-waving man, or what we call the Frenchmen, the missionaries, came into our area, they too saw the torches, the fireballs, dancing on our waters, naming our place Lac du Flambeau, which in French language means Lake of the Torch.
We'll get some more insights into the connection between Native American culture, particularly in Wisconsin, and health when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Tim Frandy and Wayne Valier, and we're looking at the connection between Native American culture in Wisconsin, Ojibwe in particular, and health. And we're calling this conversation Decolonizing Health because we're talking about how getting back into the culture improved the health of the inhabitants of the reservation, both actually on and off the reservation, come to think of it. And Tim, I know you've done some work on this issue in particular. So what progress have you seen and where has it come from in your experience working in this field?
I think a lot of the positive change that we've been seeing has actually come through something that people in the health professions refer to as environmental factors of health. And that doesn't just refer to the environment as in nature, but it refers to a number of things like education levels. People who are better educated tend to have better health outcomes. People who have better socioeconomic status, better incomes, tend to have better health. A cleaner environment, also another important indicator of how healthy you're going to be, statistically speaking.
Sure.
And so a lot of our programs are actually running through the school because we're really looking at education as a key to improving health in the community. And so lots of the cultural programs that we're running with students are going to have long-term impacts. And even in the 5 years or so we've been collaborating, we've seen high school graduation rates go up from 57% to 98%.
Wow.
The number of students currently enrolled at post-secondary educational schools increased from mid-40s to 220-some in about 3 or 4 years' time.
That's quite a return.
It's there's a lot of very positive change you can see by teaching in a cultural way and teaching in a culturally responsive manner.
And in terms of the health, too, I mean, we talked, I know, Wayne, earlier on about the health issues that early beset, you know, life on the reservation. I mean, alcoholism was one that you hear mentioned. I think back in the day there was tuberculosis also. How has the physical health improved in this period of time?
Well, one of the things is that was examined way back in the 70s throughout Native American communities, and studies showed that Native American children had the highest mortality rate out of any race in the country. There were programs and dollars sent to help with that problem. Some of it it was federal aid, some was state aid. But ultimately, in our community, we took charge of those areas through our gaming dollars.
I was going to ask about the gaming. Was that a real turnaround?
It was a real good shot in the arm that helped our tribe immensely. It created a lot of programs where we have a full-time nutritionist. We have a full-time medical clinic. We have a full-time, excellent dental clinic. We have a wellness center. We just built a 24-room alcohol and drug addiction treatment center that is helping our people in a cultural way, teaching cultural etiquette to rise above addiction. There are a lot of different things. In our school, we're working on curriculums called the Industrial Way of the Anishinaabe, which is talking about the traditional foods and how they were processed and how they were cooked a long time ago, opposed to the way they were cooked in the last 50 years. Meaning that you could see the map of sugar diabetes, heart disease, and all of these different things that have plagued our people.
Plagued other people, too.
Like what Tim was saying is totally right on. Education of our people, but not only education of our people, but providing programming that actually has an effect. We're an action team that is attacking sugar diabetes through exercise and better eating and awareness of certain foods and the importance of our spirit foods that the change in our diet has shown, you know, it was the start of worst of times for our people since we've brought that awareness into a high wild rice and venison diet and fish, we're seeing healthier people in our community. Awareness of sugar diabetes, heart disease. We have more people that are exercising, more programming, and getting our kids out, just like our Ojibwe Winter Games, getting our kids out in the wintertime, being part of their culture and exercising and eating healthy is very important to bring our nation strong once again.
Another question about gaming, and that has to do with employment. Has that really been, in addition to a financial boon, has it been a good source of employment, or does it for
yes,
Native Americans?
It's a very good source of employment, not only for Native Americans, but in Lac La Flambeau, we are the largest employer in the three surrounding counties of professional jobs.
Including non-Native Americans.
We have excellent health care benefits. We have excellent working conditions with good staff that we appreciate in Lac La Flambeau, and we take good care of our employees. And in turn, our employees take good care of our people.
You mentioned the spirit foods. Which are they?
The spirit foods are venison, berries, nuts, wild rice, fish, and certain plants, edible plants that we harvest. Now, those are the primary. We also have a secondary resource. Our secondary resource would be like the rabbits, the grouse, the waterfowl, the turkeys. And the other thing that we are examining is our the environmental impacts that are having in those rice beds, environmental impacts that we're having, that we're experiencing in those areas, that it's affecting the quality of our venison, the quality of our fish. Okay.
What are those?
Mercury from acid rain in some of our lakes that we can't harvest fish, fearing our pregnant women will be affected.
Sure.
So our Great Lakes Wildlife Commission is doing a really good job at monitoring, and our data from our biologists is what we trust, not the states.
Really? So you're actually using Ojibwe biologists?
Exactly.
And what about the rice? What's affecting that? Same
it's
thing?
It's a very, very, very much a spirit food. Mm-hmm. It brought the Ojibwe people from the eastern seaboard through a great prophecy to where food grows on water. We didn't know what that was until we got to the Great Lakes. And way on the western part of Lake Superior, we found that food that grows on water. We call it manomen, which means the good seed. And it sustained life for many generations of the Anishinaabe. And it's very high in nutrients, much higher than, and it can be preserved and stored, you know, for a long time. I was at a conference when this archaeologist pulled out a grain of rice, and it was 3,000 years old, okay? And he said that he could drop it in water and cook it, and it would be just as good as the day it was preserved.
Tim, in terms of this healthcare initiative that continues, you have it licked, or are there still challenges?
Oh, there are plenty of challenges. You know, we've had success in lactoflambo, but I think that, you know, one of the next steps is finding out how this can be brought to other communities. It works really well in lactoflambo, I think, because we have some very outstanding people there, some cultural leaders like Wayne who are willing to step forward and do things like come on a public radio show and talk about the community in ways that, you know, you might not want to do normally. You have to put yourself out there sometimes, and that can be challenging. So I think we need to figure out what's working well in the community and why it's working. Why is revitalization working well here, and maybe it's not working so well as a model in some other communities? So how can we, you know, be able to export this and do good not only in lactoflambo but in other indigenous communities around the country and the globe?
Well, so you've got source of employment for the foreseeable future. No lack of things to
I'd
do.
I'd also like to add that the programming that we've the successes from the program we've had in lactoflambo, our team was also the recipient of the Robert Woods Johnson Health Organization's Health Prize. We were a health winner this year, health prize winner. We're very honored to receiving and becoming part of the Robert Woods Johnson family of community of health and our endeavors to make a healthier Anishinaabe for generations to come.
Congratulations, both of you, for great, great progress. And thanks also for some fascinating insights into this connection between health and culture, Native American culture in particular. My guests have been Wayne Valier and Tim Frandy, and best of luck with future ventures in this area.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.